So, good morning, or next morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's my great honor and pleasure to welcome here Professor Catherine Fuller-Seeley, who come to us from the University of Texas in Austin, which is in the United States.
This is our longhorn. This is our cow. So.
And before that, she taught at Georgia State University in Atlanta and Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond. Am I right?
Yes,
Right.
yes, yes.
So her research specialization focused on American film exhibition and movie going, and I'm really glad that we can have you here.
Well.
And welcome, and let's go to them.
Terrific. Well, thank you and welcome. I'm so pleased to be here, and I look forward to meeting you and talking about many interesting things. Thank you very much for reading my publications that I assign. It's a little boring as they might be, but I hope to interest you in the research I've done on this area, and I want to sort of explain what I'm all about. I consider myself, my training is in American history, so I'm a historian, not a film scholar. And my research specialty, I was always very interested in audiences and how motion pictures and television were seen in as part of everyday life. So not just studying films as texts, but as I said, but I'm very interested in how the ritual of going to the movies came about, how it was expressed, how theaters grew up across the country. And I would be very interested in hearing how this might compare with what you all know about the experience in the Czech Republic. So as we would talk about history in the present day, because I'll be very interested to know about that. This morning, I did some research. I said, I've only been at the University of Texas 1 year. I've just moved to Texas. See, I have my hook, I'm down. But I recently learned that almost 200,000 people in my area of Texas have came from Czechoslovakia. So 200,000, we are the largest collection of people of Czech background in the United States. So I hooray. So I will have much to take home to learn about your relatives over in America. And there's so many baked goods. That's, as I said, I'm learning what they call kolaches. I don't know what you all call them, but as I said, so many little donuts, so many little baked goods, I have much to learn. So, as I said, first I wanted to tell you about how I got interested in this topic, because sort of understanding how I came up with my own dissertation research for my own first book helped sort of explain my take on how I'm interested in film exhibition and movie going. And to do that, let's see how. Yay! Okay, I need my one map. United States, of course, and you'll see it's the interest of the population back in 1910. Well, as I said, when I was just a student, a graduate student, and studying history, I was studying social history, the history of everyday life, the history of workers, of women, of African Americans, of immigrants to the United States, as opposed to my other colleagues who studied presidents and laws and the leaders at the top. My graduate program was all about studying, instead of the people at the top, the people at the bottom. As I said, everyday life of families and how popular culture and things like that impacted the areas at the top. So, as I said, here I am studying social history at the bottom, and I said, I'm very interested in motion pictures and movie going. How did it spread across the United States? That was my question. The few books that I had read, the textbooks out there, had claimed that when movies were first invented, the earliest Thomas Edison movies, D.W. Griffith movies, those early, very short movies in America, were seen only by immigrant audiences, by the very poor, the Jewish, the Russian, the German, the Czech immigrants who lived in New York City. Yeah, I'll get my pen. Who lived in New York City, or maybe in Chicago. So the books I read said that the only movie theaters, the earliest movie theaters, were in inner cities, in New York City, down where the immigrants lived, in the sections where the poorest lived. and that the people who went to see these movies were mothers and children and workers and families, but very, very poor. They then, these textbooks, then go on to say somehow, within about 20 years later, so by the 1920s, somehow motion pictures had spread across the entire United States. And they were shown in elegant, large picture palace movie theaters, and everybody went to the movies. But it was a question for me. How do you get from just the Nickelodeons in New York City with their very poor audiences to theaters all across the country? That was quite a change in 20 years. And the books couldn't explain it to me. They said maybe the coming of Charlie Chaplin or Mary Pickford. Maybe it was the stars. Maybe they had no explanation. So that was my goal for my dissertation research, was to figure out how do you get from just those little theaters to expanding all across the country. And that has to do with the reading I gave to you all. I wrote that to explain to American historians, indeed, why they must consider the whole country as a whole, instead of just thinking of just some small audiences, or on the other hand, just saying the American audience. Figuring that everyone was all the same across America, I wanted to talk about the many kinds of differences about all these different audiences up here. So, as I said, to do my dissertation research, I was very lucky. I had a fellowship to the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C., where they keep the big American flags and the ruby slippers that Dorothy wore in The Wizard of Oz, and they've got all kinds of cool stuff. But there, I was looking for different kinds of sources, because how could I tell this story about how movie theaters spread across America? And let's see what I could. The explanation I came up with of how the theaters got everywhere, one part was that the earliest movies, it was very, very easy to get a projector and to get films and to take them out and show them across the country. So one of the reasons it could spread so rapidly and not just be in New York or Chicago, as I said, was the easiest. It was so easy. Projectors could even be ordered out of the Sears Roebuck catalog, our great catalog of the company in the United States that sold things to everyone across the U.S. through a great big catalog. You could order a projector. You had to, back in the earliest days, you had to purchase the films. But it was relatively inexpensive, and the technology was so easy, you could take these projectors anywhere. You could get the light source for the projector from a light bulb. You could get it from, it's a little dangerous, but you could spark nitrogen. You could get lime light, like in the theater. You could do it. You could even run the projector off the headlights and battery of a Model T automobile. So, as I said, it was very, very easy and relatively cheap to get involved in the business. And that's what I found was when I looked at film exhibition, was I learned that dozens, hundreds, and thousands of young men and their wives, what I call mom-and-pop theaters, young men and women, just like you and me, could, I'd like to think, I'll quit being a professor. I'll go buy a projector and go out and see the world. So it was easy enough to just purchase a projector, purchase some films, and go out and start putting on shows. Another thing, so it was very easy, and it was very easy to open these early movie theaters. I'm hoping to learn that in the Czech Republic, you all had the spread of theaters like this. I'll be curious to know if your theaters were only in the larger cities like Prague and Brno, or if there were theaters all across your country. Well, this is what I learned the most of in doing my research for my dissertation, was that not only were these little theaters in New York and Chicago, but they spread everywhere across the country. It was so easy to open them. As I said, you need the projector, you need the films. You needed easy kitchen chairs. You went and a few exhibitors even borrowed them from funeral parlors when you weren't busy having burials and things like that. You took the kitchen chairs, and you put them in the theater. The room of the theater could be as simple as any kind of storefront. And many times in many towns, it would be an empty shoe store or a grocery store or a bank or a barber shop. You could take or a barn. You could take any building anywhere and put in the chairs, put in the projector, run the films. I love how the fronts were decorated. This they spread. As I said, individuals opened these theaters. It was not I ate in a Burger King in Prague. Yikes! And it was very good. I will tell you, you all have terrific Burger Kings. The hamburgers tasted just as good as the ones in Texas. I was really proud. But I want you to think the difference of today. Little outlets that are all the same spread across. I'm going to say McDonald's or Burger King or Kentucky Fried Chicken. Put the same little outlets in towns all around the world. That's not how the earliest movie theaters spread. Each one of these was individually owned. Each one of these was a young man and his wife, a family, might get an empty store, outfit it with chairs, get the projector, and then they would decorate the outside of the theaters. As many as 10,000 of these opened across the U.S. in these early years, and each one is different. I enjoyed exploring that for my dissertation, trying to say what's the meaning of the various names of the theaters. Sometimes they were named for the brightness of the projector. They'd be the light, the gem. Sometimes they were named after the gem, the diamond, the stone, something bright and sparkly. Sometimes they were named for the electricity and technology involved in it. Sometimes for the really cheap price that it cost to get in, they would be named the nickel because that was the cost, very inexpensive to get in. But they said you could fill these things with, they said there's the price, the bright lights and signs. That's all it took. So as I said, it was very easy to open these theaters. It was, there were no rules, and there was no, as I said, it was not done as a chain. It was not done as a corporate kind of thing. And that allowed them to spread, if I go back to here, everywhere across the U.S. so fast. As I said, that really interested me. In the article I gave you, as I said, this is something I needed to tell other film historians who hadn't taken any history, and they assumed either that the earliest theaters were only in New York or in Chicago, those population centers, or that they were same all the way across the U.S. They assume it was much more like a McDonald's, and I wanted to tell them that the whole business of doing local case studies, local histories, and local case studies of exhibition was one way to try and chart the many differences that were going on in between these little theaters and the way they responded to different conditions in the U.S. So again, a bit more of my history lesson for film historians is to tell them that in part the difference in motion picture exhibition across the country had much to do with American history and American geography. Up in New England, up in New York and the New England states, the towns are very close together. These were the earliest settled in the U.S., and so the farms are very small and the towns are very close by. So there are many, many tiny little theaters. This area also became more manufacturing, so many small and large little factories, but it meant that they had many theaters close together. On the other hand, if you see out here in the West, wide open spaces, in the West, big ranches, more with those cows. Very little population and very widely spread. So there would be many fewer theaters, many more theaters up in New England, many fewer theaters over here. As I said, the things I have to tell citizens. Interestingly, in the northern Midwest, these are the Dakotas. That's Minnesota over here. This is the farming area of the Great Plains. But in the northern part, the farmers were much more well-to-do. They farmed wheat on great large farms, but they were much more likely to have automobiles, to have the transportation to go into town to go to one of these theaters. and they had the money. They were relatively prosperous. So there are many, many more theaters, even though the population of these towns are little. There are many, many more theaters up in the north, but relatively speaking, many fewer theaters down here in the American South. The American South, here from Virginia and the Carolinas and Florida over to Texas, this area is the one of the most different areas in the U.S. This area, much more poor. After the Civil War and the plantations died, after the plantations and slavery were over, this whole area is very mired in poverty. All the farmers were very poor. They didn't have money, and they didn't have transportation. They didn't own automobiles. They couldn't afford radios. The few times they could go to town, they didn't even have nickels to go to the movie theater. So, and on top of that, most blacks, the African Americans, most in 1910, they all lived down here. And the racism was terrible. So, as I said, I'll be very interested to learn more about Czech history, to see if you all have any kind of, to learn more about what kind of ethnic differences you all might have had. Was there much immigration to the Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia back at the time? I know there is now. But, as I said, this was the big American problem down here, was the split population of whites and blacks. Now, even though, as I said, so everybody's poor, but the racism involved made for movie theaters an even worse situation, because whites refused to sit in the same theater with blacks. And so the little theaters would have a huge problem even getting in enough people to pay the money. So they would either have to have a whites-only theater with no blacks allowed, but the whites might only make up half the population of the town. So all of a sudden, your audience is much smaller, and they're poor. Sometimes the theaters would split the theater and have the whites downstairs and the blacks upstairs. This was a problem because the blacks said, hey, you know, we're being discriminated against. We don't like that. So they didn't want to go. And the whites are going, rrr. So, as I said, it was really difficult in the South, if you were a movie theater owner, to try and make ends meet. So it was a very, very difficult, very, very difficult down here. And so we have sort of wealthy, very poor. Out here on the West Coast, you see there are, interestingly, very few theaters here across the mountain states, but out here there tended to be people who lived in California up through Washington State tended to live in larger cities. So, as I said, fewer theaters, but those on the West Coast lived in larger cities. So, as I said, very different patterns all across the U.S. Now, another sort of similarity or difference from what you all had going on, at least for as large as this country is, we about only had one language. So one major language, most, the official language of English. And our dialects between the areas, the southern dialect, the northern dialect, they were not so severe that you couldn't understand each other. So our language was written the same way, if pronounced a little bit differently, but it's certainly nothing like the language differences that some parts of Europe had, because I understand some Germans didn't understand the dialects were so severe. Not the problem in the U.S. So here is something that benefited motion pictures spreading across the U.S. Of course, another thing that would help with the earliest films was that they didn't need a language. You could, for the silent film titles, you could take them out and substitute something in another language. So that, say, down here in Texas, we have a lot of Spanish-speaking immigrants from Mexico coming up to Texas. Well, what I learned theaters in, like, El Paso did was you could cut out the subtitles and put in Spanish ones so that Charlie Chaplin was known as Carlos. It worked. So, as I said, that was a help to spread theaters across the U.S. pretty quickly. So, as I said, no language differences really to speak of. But, as I said, on the other hand, racism was really terrible. Now, how am I doing? Other factors. So, as I said, why I like to use a map. Showing my film history colleagues the importance of thinking about differences in American culture really is important to trying to educate them about how you can't just think of the American film audience. You must think differently. I have one colleague who found an interesting thing in North Carolina, had three different populations, had the whites, had the blacks, had Indians, Native Americans. There were a few Native Americans left in this area of North Carolina, and the movie theater had to try and compromise by splitting the theater in three. There were three separate seating sections. This was very confusing and made the audiences all angry, because the whites would say, we don't want to sit with either of them. The blacks would say, we don't want to sit with the Indians. And the Indians would say, we don't want to sit with either the whites or blacks. So the end result in that theater, in that town, was nobody went to the movies. And the theaters were small and terrible. This situation changed a little bit. As I said, if my question from my own dissertation research was, how did we get from just the little tiny theaters to this spread of motion pictures across the country? In part, that depended on the movement of the American film industry from New York and the Edison, Biograph, D.W. Griffith kind of one-reel filmmaking to the second generation of American filmmaking, which moved out to Hollywood. The coming of this second generation of film studios, the ones that became classic Hollywood, the Fox, Universal, MGM, Paramount, Warner Brothers, those studios did a lot to change and cement movie theaters across the country, because what they did that was different was that they wanted to control how the movie theaters across the country got their films. The Edison Biograph people didn't care. They're just selling them. They didn't care. Just cranking them. You know, they didn't care. These studios out here tried a different factor. They wanted to, and that they were really important in building the picture palaces. What these people wanted to do was to provide a steady market. They really wanted to be smart management control of the theaters all across the country. So what they did that was different is they came up with contracts for these various movie theaters. And they said, if you want to show one of our films, you must show all of our films. Instead of these folks that said, buy one, buy 10, it doesn't matter. These people made it more organized, but made a lot more difficult for the movie theaters. So they said, to buy one movie, you must buy our year's worth of movies. This gave them a continuing stream of money. This is very good management thinking from their point of view, because they said, now we will know how many theaters are going to play our films. It also, very interestingly, it allowed them to divide up the country into each of them had their own zones of influence. MGM, per se, decided to conquer the South. So they made most of their contracts, and then they started building theaters themselves. So, as I said, MGM purchased and built theaters in the Carolinas, in Atlanta, Georgia, down here in New Orleans, over here in Houston and Dallas. And so they said, we will have this part of the country. Now, Warner Brothers bought Pennsylvania and Ohio. So they went for that area. Fox went for the West Coast, and they purchased and took over most of the theaters there. Paramount went for Chicago and also New York. So, as I said, the Hollywood companies divided up the whole country. And instead of just the sort of willy-nilly, they said, each of us will dominate in each area. But they said, we'll also work together, because every theater eventually needed all the product to show movies 365 days a year. The theaters needed all the product of not only their major theater, but also the other theaters. So these MGM theaters here in the South would take all the MGM movies, which would be about 52 feature films a year, one for every week of the year, 52, but you would need other films. And so you would fill in with a few Warner Brothers and a few Fox. Out here, the Fox people, you'd take all 52 Fox films. But then you would fill in with, oh, I'll need to take a few Paramounts and a few Universals. In Paramount territory, you'd have to take all 52 Paramounts, but fill in with a few Warner Brothers and a few MGM films. I know it sounds a little confusing, but as I said, it's a very interesting way to make sure that the whole country got covered and the whole country's managed. Here, one of the biggest problems of that system, though, is if you are an independent filmmaker and you've made a film, this system went in from 1915 until 1960. But if you came to the United States back in that 1915 to 1960 period with a movie you had just made and you said, I want Americans to see it. I want to show it in American movie theaters. No one would show your film. These contracts that the studios made forbid, that they were so controlling that they said, no, the movie theaters will not be able to show anything other than the films we've contracted them for. So, again, that's one of the reasons why, you know, you may have learned that Americans saw very few European films. We saw mostly only Hollywood product because this is the way Hollywood wanted it. So it was very, very difficult as that system got into place for anybody to see anything other than American films. There were a few exceptions. European cinema could be seen in a few select theaters in the major urban centers. New York and Chicago had German theaters and French theaters, Yiddish movie theaters, other kinds of international cinemas, but only in the most urban areas. The rest of the country didn't get to see anything other than Hollywood product. I find it really interesting, as I said, to try and understand how this stuff is all organized. Now, there we go. If my goal was to understand how these little theaters all across the country became these theaters, elegant picture palaces. Back when I did my dissertation research, this was the problem that the historians couldn't answer for me. How did so many little theaters? Where did these big theaters come from? If America was happy with the little bitty theaters, these beautiful what we call picture palaces. Has anybody ever said? Do they have any of these left here? Maybe for the opera or something like that. Some big theater somewhere. Most of our in the U.S. Most of our picture palaces are gone. They were I would say they were built out of cardboard. They were not built to last, but they certainly were beautiful and elegant. The picture palaces came about because of the involvement of those Hollywood studios. In the same way that they said, we'll separate and organize all the American territory to make sure we're in control of it. The studios put the money into building these big things. And they said they will be the crown jewels of our theater empires. And so, MGM built picture palaces in Atlantic, Georgia, in Charlotte, North Carolina, in Houston and New Orleans. And you would build this elegant movie palace. And it would be, as I said, it would be the place where their new movies were premiered and shown first. They owned those picture palaces, but they didn't have to own the rest of the theater. Unlike McDonald's, they didn't have to own all the theaters. As long as they owned the top, those picture palaces were only about the top 10%, only the top 10% of American movie theaters. But they charged the most, they had the most elegance, they had the best reputation, and they could then sort of control everything that happened out in the hinterland. So, as I said, MGM built their picture palaces here. Fox built their picture palaces out on the West Coast. Warner Brothers built their picture palaces in Pennsylvania and Ohio. So, as I said, the whole country would be, the largest cities then had these elegant movie theaters controlled by one of the various studios, and then all the other little theaters would be bound up by these contracts to have to show the same films. They didn't have to own the other 90% of the theaters, but by the contracts of where you showed the films, that's how they controlled things. So by about 1920, 1930, the U.S. then was much more stable, was much more of a national audience. That's it. So to go in from just sort of 1895 or 1900, from so many little individual theaters and no organization at all, to by the 20 years later, by the 1920s, a much more rigid organization of theaters and what product, what movies were getting shown in what places is put into place across the U.S. That's a pretty rapid development. And so they said, but that was my goal. I wanted to understand how that system came into place and became so, so controlling. It all broke down, those of you who know your film history, that whole system lasted until after World War II. In the 1950s and 1960s, that whole system they'd put into place fell apart. And it's a kind of, well, sad story. No, it's a happy story. Part of what happened was the invention of television. With the coming of, with television came rapidly across the U.S., and Americans started watching television and going to the movies less and less. Americans moved out of away from the old city centers, and we had the growth of a lot of suburbs, a lot of new houses outside of city centers. And when Americans moved away from city centers, they quit going to those old picture palaces downtown. So they quit going to the movies. They moved away from the city centers. They were watching television. They were busy having babies and not going to movies. And so that whole system kind of shut down. So it's very sad. Today, there are still very many movie theaters in the U.S., but it's very few of these. We have most of these are all closed, as are most of these are all closed. Much like maybe what you all have here, our cinemas are now the multiplexes, really sort of new things, again, out away from city centers, out in the suburbs. So it's a whole new generation of movie theaters. But as I said, I'm especially interested in these old ones, especially in the local ones of these, because to me, studying these, it became much more about the weekly practice of going to the movies rather than going to see a particular film. It's not about going to see Harry Potter or going to see Avatar or going to, you know, see Star Wars, but it was the fact that you went to these things like several nights a week with the same people in the audience. It was a little crummy theater, but it was those weekly movie-going practices that I find interesting to study. So they said that's the kind of thing we did in this the collection for which you read the introduction to. I mostly wanted to establish that there was a history and that there were differences, but also I was very curious in the importance of studying individual case studies as opposed to thinking of the American audience. I wanted to ask other historians, what is it worth if we study these individual case studies? And I hope these are kinds of projects that you all might be interested in doing here, because we can all do individual case studies. But indeed, I want to talk a little bit about what kinds of sources, how do you write those stories, and what might they tell us? Well, among the sources I use to try and write these little stories are photographs. When I can find pictures of these movie theaters, I find them very interesting because I could see what are the posters. I could think about that. I could look at the decoration. As I said, I'm interested even in their names and what that meant for the community that they were on. So all those kinds of things. Another source I use, this one, I'll be curious to hear what you all can tell, have been able to learn about publications for movie fans. The interesting story of fan publications in the U.S. was they started in 1911, very early, but they were started by the studios. The Edison, Biograph, the D.W. Griffith Studio actually started these initial publications. Warily, they were a little scared, but they said maybe we're on to something. interesting what they provided was they turned all the very the one reel and two reel films into short novels. So what the earliest fan publications were all about presenting the writing to story form the narratives of the films, and these magazines did pretty well. But very quickly, the publishers found out that the fans wanted something different, and what the fans wanted, they wanted to hear about movie stars. They wanted to hear about Charlie Chaplin. They wanted to hear about motion picture actresses. They wanted to know what are their names, because all these stars were anonymous at the time. And they said, "Oh, it's nice to give us the story of the picture, but we want the details of their private life. We want all the dirty scoop, all the tabloid gossip and things like that." So the fan magazines that had only wanted to publish the stories of the films start to gingerly publish a few pictures of the actors and actresses and start to put them on the covers of the magazines. And then the people who are reading it say, "We want to talk with each other." And they start, I don't have a picture of it here. They start writing in letters to the magazine saying, "Please tell us the name of this actress. Please tell us what her height and weight are. Please tell us what she eats for breakfast. Please tell us who she is dating. Who is she romantically inclined?" And so these little magazines that I said had started with just the stories start to respond to the fans. And they start to say, they have a column where they say, "Dear Miss Jones, yes, this woman's name is Norma Talmadge. Yes, she is 5'2". She eats granola for breakfast." But then the magazine said, "No, we will not tell you who she's dating." For the Biograph studio, they said, "We will not tell you their names." That Biograph studio said, "If you know the identities of these actors will demand a higher salary. They will become stars and they will become obnoxious." And so the Biograph studio said, "No, we will not tell you anything." But the other studios started capitulating and providing more and more information about these celebrities. It's been very interesting to read for a number of years, for about 3 or 4 years, these publications had this section where the fans could write in and want to know more information. And those sections grew from just one page to 2 pages to 30 pages to 40 pages at the back of the publication. They become really interesting to read. And they become the first example that I have seen of what today we do on the internet. What today it would be a discussion board, or it would be, "I'm going to join Brad Pitt's fan club and I'm going to write in articles, you know, I'm going to draw pictures, I'm going to write stories." So all of that was happening, being published in this magazine, and that section grows and grows and grows. The fans draw pictures of the movie stars, they write poems, they start talking to each other in the fan magazines, sort of addressing each other and writing back and forth. It's fascinating to read, to see all this interest in movie fans, what their favorite genres are. Do they like westerns? Do they like romances? More things. They want to collect post pictures of the movie stars to put up in their own homes. And so these fan magazines become this really interesting, very rich resource to read about all the ways that that movie fans across the country are becoming interested in this. Well, by about 1916, the movie studios go, "Nope, we're not going to do this anymore." And so they now reduce the portion of the magazine that fans can contribute to. The first thing they do is kick out the men. The magazines publish little, I'm going to say, articles, cartoons, jokes about, if you're a man, you shouldn't be a movie fan, because that means you're strange, because it means that you're a girly man. It means that you are flighty and you are too involved in fantasy, and it's not appropriate for men to be movie fans. So they literally do everything they can to stop men from reading this magazine. And they say only females, only young women should be movie fans. And then they start in on the female movie fans. They say, if you're a young woman, if you're a woman and you're a movie fan, you're too involved in fantasy. You're too involved in movie stars. Stop doing this. And literally, by about 1916, they take that vibrant fan publication that's going on in the fan magazines, and they remove it altogether. And the fan, after 1916, the fan magazines are all about pictures of actresses. So that's it's all that they want a female readers. But no more can female readers write in to tell their side of the story. It becomes a sort of a one-way publication back out. So they said, I love the, one source for talking about early movie fans and their interaction with each other and all the different things they produce are in the earliest fan magazines. After 1916, they're still very interesting, but now it becomes a sort of one-way story about let us tell you about the glamour of these movie stars. Let us make up the fictions of the lives of these glamorous people. No more of you getting to write in and ask us things. So, as I said, the fan magazines have been one of my favorite sources for looking at the variety of fan responses, especially in that early era. I'm going to talk about this a little later this afternoon, that the trade journals for film exhibitors, for the movie theater managers, also end up being a very interesting place of texts I could read to see ongoing conversations about what individual movie theater owners would like to please their patrons. And I found at least one source where, that, as I said, that I'll be telling you about later, where they end up talking to each other about what do our audiences want, especially what do small town audiences want that are different from city audiences. I'll talk more about that later. But trade journals. Another very interesting area that I found for thinking about movie going in popular culture and how it built up and how it spread were things like I found these at the Smithsonian Institution. Someone had donated a collection of like 700,000 pieces of sheet music. Before there were recordings, before records were prominent, there was a very lively music industry, but it was sheet music. Most individuals, most of you and I would have had instruments in our home, and most people made their own music. You learned how to, you could play the piano or you could play the guitar or a trumpet or something. But music circulated, as in famous performers sang songs, but then the lyrics of the song with a beautiful cover were published and sent to music stores all across the country. And you and I, we would go to the music store often and want to hear the latest songs. But I'd say, unlike turning on the radio and hearing Beyonce sing her newest song, we would go, oh, what has Beyonce been singing lately? Let me go to the music store and find her latest song with maybe a picture of her on the cover. I will take it home and learn to play it myself. So music stores would have people on hand there to play the newest songs for you to get you interested in it. But as I said, I want you to think music was also distributed very differently back in the day. But I found this interesting intersection with pop music writers writing songs about everything new going on in American culture. I found songs about driving automobiles. Come away with me, Lucille, in my merry oldsmobile. I found songs about going to the dime store, to the inexpensive store. I saw songs about going out to restaurants. Songs about take me out to the ball game, going to see a baseball or football match. So this is nothing new, but pop culture songwriters like to write songs about things that were new and interesting in American culture. So I found that they, as movie going spread across the country as something that people were interested in, folks would write songs about it. One song I found called Let's Go Into a Picture Show is about a bright young woman who's very excited about going to the movies. She says, let's go into a picture show because I love it so. On the square, there isn't anywhere that I would ever go. The purpose of the song is not to see the films, but to be in the darkened theater. The whole purpose of the song, this young woman is trying to get her boyfriend to come into the theater with her. It will be the only place in public where it's dark and they can kiss and make out. So the whole idea, the whole importance of going to the picture show is that chance to make out and feel each other up and to kiss. And that. So this, I again, I love examples like this to go, That's why you go to the movies. It's not to see the movie on the screen. It's to make out. It's to kiss and hug and feel each other up. But you could also see that's what would make stern elderly people go, oh, the movies are bad. Because they're not going in to see the films. They're going in to do terrible things. So, on the other hand, I found this fabulous song. This was written by Irving Berlin, who wrote, like, God Bless America, other kinds of songs. This is an early song he wrote, and of the whole, the story of this song, this is sung by a young woman, and the chorus is, if that's your idea of a wonderful time, take me home. The story of the song is that this young man has offered to take her out on a date. And when she agrees to go out with him, but not Mr. Big Spender at all. What happens on the date is he takes her to a restaurant, buys her one cup of coffee. Woo! They have one cup of coffee. Then he says, I know the manager of the theater. We will get into the theater for free. And let's go and watch the show three times over. And so she's going, you're not spending money on me. This is not a date. What did I get all dressed up for? So that's the reason why the line of her chorus is going, if that's your idea, if going to the movies is your idea of a wonderful time, take me home. I don't want anything about it. So I love to contrast these ideas that spread into American popular culture of what's the popularity, what are the upsides and downsides of going to the movies. Here, it's the place for, it's as I said, it's this place in public, and I have to tell my undergraduates that American culture used to be very different, that there were so many rules, that young men and women didn't get to go out and hook up and do anything kind of thing like that. Everything had to be proper. You had to be chaperoned. You had to go to church suppers together. The movie theater was one of the first new places on Main Street that were cheap to go to so that you could get in. It wasn't expensive, but it's dark inside and intimate, and you can sit there and nudge and kiss and squeak, and you can do all those kind of things together for only 5 cents. So, like I said, the movie theater to some people represented this sort of new space of freedom and anonymity, even in a small town. If it's dark enough, and even though your parents are in the back, you can scooch down. And so, like I said, all kind of freedom and anonymity, even in the smallest town. On the other hand, this piece of sheet music reminds me that not everyone thought that going to the movies was a good thing. If you were a young woman of society, of pretensions, or if you're a gold digger and want the guy to spend money on you, the movies, way too cheap. So, way too bad. So, there's my picture palace again. Oh, that's for other kinds of stuff. So, like I said, back to my map. These are the kinds of subjects that, as I said, my colleagues, the folks who put essays in my book and I wanted to talk about. We wanted to talk about sort of regional variations. To tell many, many, many kinds of different stories, as opposed to this idea that there's one story of movie going across America. And that's kind of the difference of moving from a, let's analyze the films, let's do a textual analysis of the films. That kind of, when you start from the film, you kind of think about the national audience as a whole. And I'm going to keep hitting this chair many times. But if, on the other hand, if you start from the particularities of the individual movie theater, you might have many stories to tell. Other kinds of sources, we looked at, and other things I had to talk to you about this week. I have found instances of movie fans keeping scrapbooks, and when I have found those kind of documents, I like to read them like an anthropologist might or an art historian. What movie stars did somebody paste and collect into their books? What was interesting for that individual movie fan? What indeed did they want to save? Was it a program from a movie theater? Was it pictures of movie stars? What about the movie-going experience was interesting to one person? Other kinds of sources might involve, for my research, I really love, I'm going to say, ripping off other academics, sociologists and child welfare agencies, all kinds back in the day. Many people were, adults were very concerned about this impact of movie going, especially on children, and they would do studies of movie going patterns. I love to get those old studies and try to read them against the grain. Jane Addams, the reformer in Chicago, did a number of studies about movie theaters and children. Now, there were many immigrant poor children in her inner city Chicago neighborhood. On the one hand, she was really worried that if the children were in the movie theater, they weren't at home listening to their parents or being controlled by their school teachers or their ministers or the church or things like that. But what she learned, she actually went to the movie theaters and she saw that for the children, it was this one place where they could have fantasy and stories and something interesting that enlivened their dull little lives in a poor section of Chicago. So she actually became a fan and she actually built a movie theater into her sort of orphanage and places she built, recreation centers for young immigrant children. And so she began to believe in the usefulness of the movies for them. So that's one kind of story. What other kind of... I'll tell you later. A group of sociologists worried that movie going is bad for children and movies should be censored. There's all kinds of things. They collected a number of interviews. And I'll tell you later I'll be talking about a group of life histories, stories written by individuals of how I grew up going to the movies. They were collected by a professor at the University of Chicago. He actually used his college students. This professor asked each of them, write out your history. What's the first movie you remember seeing? It would be like, can I remember the first movie? He asked them, can you remember the first movie? What was the theater like? Did you go with your family? Did you go with your parents? What kinds of movies did you like to see? Did you like westerns? Did you like cartoons? Did you like scary movies? Did you ever play movie related games? Were you ever frightened? Did the movies ever give you ideas about sex? Were you curious about sex from watching movies? He then also asked the students, did the movies ever make you want to commit a crime? If you saw a safecracker or a bandit, did you want to become a bandit because you saw the movies? I was able to gather these. I've found a collection of these statements that the professor got his students to give him, and indeed, that's one of the readings you all have for later. Because it's very hard to find this stuff. So wherever I can gather it, I pull it in. But those stories from those young people are one of the only collections of firsthand accounts I have of people growing up from the time they're very little in those earliest in nickel movie theaters and the impact of movie going on them. So they said, I use those kind of sources. I use picture kind of sources. I've got, let me see if I can get back out of this. Aha. Okay. I'm going to make that smaller. I'm going to try and get back to here. I want to show you some more pictures. This is one picture. Another marvelous story. Let's see if I can. Oh, no. Oh. Oops, this is where. I wonder. Ah, I got it. Yay! I'm speaking Czech. No, sorry. This is another useful source I found. When I tell you that earliest motion pictures, that one young man and his wife could get involved, this was not something that the other film historians knew about. This is another way in which the earliest motion pictures got across the country so rapidly was through traveling exhibitors. This young fella, Bert Cook, from a small town in upstate New York, he gathered all his money. He was able to buy a motion picture projector, and he bought five films, each, you know, 30 seconds long. His young wife could play piano, and they took their show on the road. So before there were the nickel theaters, the people like the Cook and Harris Company assembled a movie show and took it from town to town to town to town. And I claim that they did a great deal to introduce many different audiences to motion pictures and to get that habit started. This is yet another way in which I'm trying to argue that those audiences only in New York City don't represent the rest of the country. So I luckily found their papers. It's very interesting. He kept all his papers stuffed into one big trunk. And they played one night stand. So they had to take the projector and the films, and they went from town to 10 miles away, the next town, to the next town, to the next town, the next night, the next town, the next town, the next town. And it fascinates me. Every single night, he had to unpack his projector, put it together, show the films. They would put on a show, and then he'd have to pack it all back up, and they would go down the road to the next town. So they said they ended up traveling a circuit that went all the way through the New England states up into French-speaking Canada, and they didn't speak French, and they were very afraid. And all the way, so they traveled over lots of places. Here was a problem that, the interesting thing they did was Bert took all these little bitty films. As I said, 30 seconds here, 30 seconds there. And he and his wife, Fanny, assembled it into a two-hour-long show. Now, if we just study those early texts, if we just study the 30-second long movies, we can't understand what they're showing. So finding the papers of their operation, I found they would arrange them. He took all these little brief films. He would sort of make a kind of emotional narrative out of them. He would have a section about a fire and firemen in their fire truck running to the fire. He'd have a section of comic films. So it would be, a little child falling into a puddle, somebody sneezing, somebody that's spilling water on themselves. He would arrange these things, and they would either make you laugh and get funnier and funnier. Then he'd have a section that would make you more and more nervous and scared. He'd have a section that make you, like magic tricks. He loved Méliès films. And he would say, oh, look at these. Well, he would pull together a number of these little films, and then every so often he would stop, and instead they would sing songs. Those same people who did the sheet music, when I'm not falling all tripping all over the place, the people who made those sheet music, you remember my my folks who did the. The same folks who did this, who did the sheet music, would try also to popularize these songs. They would, it's kind of like primitive music videos. It's very interesting back in 1900. They would take the story of the song, and they would go with a photographer, and they would take a number of pictures that illustrated the song. She's only a bird in a gilded cage. They would have a picture of this young woman. They would put her in a cage. She would look sad and lonely. They would take pictures of this. And the music publishers would put this together into a collection of slides, like maybe 10 slides, and they would hand color them. The slides would be beautiful. But then they would take the slides and they would virtually give them away for free to anyone who would be willing to sing the song. Show the slides, sing the song, because your hope was that all of you in the audience who would hear that song would go, I must go down to the music store and pay. I must spend my 25, I must buy that song. I liked it a lot. So my folks, Bert and Fanny Cook, were able to, as I said, they put together short collections of these films, and then they would stop and they would sing one of these songs. La da 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 da. Again, building a different kind of narrative, but what I love about it is they spent very little money on this. This was putting this together, this show together on a shoestring, very little money. So, like I said, they put all this together into a two-hour-long program. And then they played a different town every night. Well, they had a problem. As I said, in the very earliest days, you had to purchase the film. It's not like you rented it for a night. You end up, and you paid a lot of money for this 30-second film of Picture of Niagara Falls. Or, train entering station. You know, you've seen the Black Diamond Express train moving across the lines. You have a train coming at you. Ah, you got to get out of the way. But they had to make that film last as long as possible. Here was a big problem, because they were not the only ones on the road. This was such an easy business to get into, and soon 5 and 10 other couples are on the road showing the same films. One night, one night, one night in different towns. Well, they began to have trouble. They employed one fellow who traveled 2 weeks ahead of the show, come into a town and try to arrange, where can I show the film? Who will help me show the film? I will go to the church. I will go to the ladies' aid. I will go to the men's fraternal lodges. And they would say, the man would say to the groups, if you will help sell my tickets and promote the show, put up the posters and help me with the show, I will give you half the box office proceeds. Here was a way of trying to get, as I said, to convince more people to want to come to the show, because you'd be then asking all your friends, look, support my group, come to the show. So they're doing that, and in town after town after town, but the man who goes in to book the shows ahead of time, he goes to the groups and they say, oh, let me see the program. Oh, train entering station. I've seen that 10 times. That's boring. That's old. Ugh. So they faced a real problem in that, as I said, having purchased all these films, they could, after the first 10 times you showed them, everybody's seen it. And they get turned down. Well, what ended up for my couple is that they ended up especially showing in the smallest towns possible. They often showed in villages of 2,000 people or fewer, because every time they tried to go to a larger city and put on their show, people would go, that's old reruns. This is awful stuff. Get out of here. But in the smallest towns where maybe 10 other shows hadn't gone, they could still, you know, be showing something new and something different. And they also worked a lot of local connections. Bert would say, I'm a member of the same church. I'm Episcopalian like you are. Or I belong to the same lodge. So they would work all these local connections and work in very small towns. Now, curious, they were able to do this and go town to town to town to town to town for 10 years. This fascinates me that they were able to do this stay on the road for 10 years. But at the end of 10 years, in about 1910, they were the only places they could put on their show were villages of 300 people. They were down to, because everywhere else had already gotten these permanent movie theaters. And I make the argument that it is my earlier folks traveling for 10 years, town to town to town to town to town, that introduced so many small town audiences to the movies. And they would go, you came once to town. I liked the show. I would like to go see the show with different movies more often. So, helped by once the New York manufacturers started making more and more movies so that you didn't have to purchase them, but maybe you could rent them for one night. Once more motion pictures started getting made and distribution changed so that instead of having to purchase it for all time, you could rent it for one night, that really helped the spread of these little theaters. So because these theaters showed different films every night of the week, and as up to 5 movies a night, 5 one-reel films, 5 10-minute films, but they would show 5 different films every night of the week. For that, you need a lot more organization and a lot more distribution. But I argue that, as I said, it took the hard work of earliest folks like this to set up and get small town audiences ready for and anxious to have nickel theaters like this. And it's then their excitement of having these kind of theaters, these little theaters, and going, I go every night. This is really wonderful. How they get to the next, how you get from these to these, is through the growth of not just the little 5-minute films, but as the new California filmmakers start to make feature-length films. So not just many little 5-minute films, but one long narrative, a feature-length sort of Hollywood film that has a star like Mary Pickford or Gloria Swanson. And it comes with more elaborate publicity and more bigger posters and all that. Those kind of films it was easier to imagine being shown in a more elaborate setting than those little tiny films in the little kind of mom and pop nickel place. So I think it's very interesting that the growth and change in American film production, from the little films to bigger films to stars and feature-length films, is kind of paralleled and works hand-in-hand with the growth and changes of these movie theaters. Like I said, I like to think how they kind of go together. How am I doing on time? I've been talking for a while, but has any of this raised questions? Is any of this, do you see any of this happening today? Or is this all completely gone? Something I tell students is that I find kind of interesting that I think that these little theaters showing the short little films are kind of like, do you all have YouTube? That's my students. I spend a lot, well, I'm very old, but when I go online and look at brief videos on YouTube, YouTube videos are only like 7 or 9 minutes long. And when I watch a picture of a cat, the internet is filled with cats. When I watch a video of a silly thing a cat does, and then on the side it will show me many other options of other silly videos with cats. Or if I watch an old, so in a way, that kind of film experience of many different little things is rather reminiscent of what this kind of experience of watching films in those little theaters was like. So, as I said, I like to tell my undergraduates that we are living in this sort of new, when it comes to online videos, in a way, an era like the nickel theaters. Again, I also like to remind them that increasingly, if you are a filmmaker, you are back in the era of Burt and Fanny Cook. Now, that it's so hard to get the individual film you all make, filmmakers. You make a film, can you get it in your multiplex down the road? No, you're not going to be able to show it there. What you have to do when you make your film is maybe you put it online, maybe you try to charge money to see it, maybe you sell downloads, maybe you do a Kickstarter campaign to fund for it. So in a way, you as filmmakers today cannot count on a system like Hollywood to put your movie out there unless you're very wealthy. Among the very lucky and elite directors can get that kind of Hollywood, that kind of global film distribution. But you as an individual filmmaker are about down to having to barnstorm like these and become your own exhibitor. You make the film, but now increasingly you have to worry about distributing it. And so you might have to go around and take it to film festivals and show it individually. As I said, you might have to put it online and attract customers to it, the way they went town to town to town, attracting customers to it. I like to think that, as I said, I always like to make connections between things happening now and to say, we've had this before, or oops, there are many similarities. So as to my good old map, this is one of the hardest things, is to say, is there any difference anymore in the way that, and I think that's the coming of classical Hollywood film with that sort of standard distribution structure, and then the rise of television and broadcasting that sent the same picture, the same television show to audiences all across the country. I think that's why kind of my stories all stop about 1950, is that today it's a lot harder in the United States to think that there are regional differences. And like I said, I'm looking for them all the time, but I kind of come to the conclusion, like my film historians at the beginning, who said, oh no, all of film culture in America is all alike. In part, I say, well, in many ways today, yes. Although, on the other hand, what we have going on today is that with so many people watching their films through Netflix, watching it on your computer, watching it on your telephone instead of gathering together in movie theaters, the one thing we don't have is this idea of communal gathering. So, as I said, we may have all the same movies to watch, But I'll be really curious to see how in our academic studies of all the different audiences across America, how do we get, how do we think about any sense of community? Are just people, individuals watching individual films at any time? One of the things about having movie theaters and communities was people would talk and discuss the movies they had seen. And does that get harder when we no longer have these gathering spaces but all watch the movies on our individual computers? Raises questions for me about how am I going to research today, you know, and in the future, how are we going to research what's going on today? It's one thing for me to be looking in the past. But I, as I said, I've been yammering on for a while. Did anybody have any questions from that reading or things you just want to know about? I'll tell you funny stories about my students in Texas. They drive me nuts. So they're so adorable. All my undergraduates want to be filmmakers. We have, at my university, 1,000 film studies majors out of there may be 50,000 students on the campus. I understand you all have a big campus too. But we have one of the largest departments outside of, say, biology, the sciences. Outside of the sciences, we have one of the largest majors. And I'm very proud to be at our program. Our most famous graduate is Matthew McConaughey. Oh, the students go, oh, Matthew. But he's coming back to campus now, and he wants to cheer on our football team, and he wants to help the students get careers in film. So we have one famous graduate. Lord, help us. So. So, other kinds of questions? How many, I'm curious, how many of you all are filmmakers? Have been involved? Any of you media makers yourselves, or are you all studies people? Anybody here get your camera out and make things? Some. Well, no, that's good. I find my students, it's very interesting. Although, as I said, I'm a historian, I'm very happy to have my students make projects for their final papers instead of taking the exam. They like this a lot. And what I find is they'll actually work three times as hard on making the project rather than taking the exam, so I win. But I'm very interested to see that they all help each other. One will be the actor in another one's film, one will do the sound work, another will do the camera work, and so I like how it involves a lot of collaboration. But I've been teaching courses at University of Texas. I taught a great course on comedy, which was great because we did a lot of stand-up performance. So it was really interesting to see how that concept of comedy moves beyond sort of old. We did older films. I did a lot with Charlie Chaplin. I'm a big Chaplin fan. And I did a little bit on Hollywood, but we found Hollywood kind of boring. We did a lot with, you all have, we did a lot of comedy in the news. I don't know, we have comedy news programs. We have one called The Daily Show. We have comics who pretend to be telling us the news, but they're actually making very sharp political commentary, laughing, pretending to be idiots, and things like that. So we also have a lot of stand-up performers. Comedy is a very interesting way to talk about racial difference and sexual difference if we have a female comic. So I was curious, sort of what American TV shows are over here, do you all watch now? Do you have 30 Rock? Do you have Mad Men? Do you have Sopranos? What? Huh? What? Is there anything you all are watching now from American from American television? Cooking show.
I think American TV shows are pretty popular here. We are watching it pretty often.
Well, good. I mean, it's very interesting. I'm really intrigued. I have colleagues who study now the sort of global formats. They're very interested not that just American shows are coming overseas, but that shows like Idol, American Idol, British Idol, Israeli Idol, that so many, so you can sing, so you can dance, that some of these shows that each nation can make, every country can have their own version. Britain's Got Talent. You know, that's other kinds of shows. So we're really interested in that, and the way, as I said, other, especially in what we call reality TV, like cooking shows or Survivor shows or Big Brother or Big Housewives of. So it's interesting today to see, instead of just American shows going out overseas, that I would like to think that there's lots more different kinds of shows going all over the place. Still in America, we see very, it's terrible, where we see very little of what is produced around the rest of the world. But my goal for you all is to not just be covered with American television, but that that you all, on your television, are there many Czech television productions? Or are you watching more German, French, British? I'm curious. Are there many shows being made here in the country? Because I would hope that you could get jobs there. If there are not very many filmmaking jobs, I would hope that there would be television jobs. That's what my students back at Texas are hoping for. In America, the film industry, you know, other than blockbusters, other than making Iron Man or, you know, something about a comic book, the Avengers, Iron Man, one of these kind of things. Most of the talk in America right now is about making these television shows. And whether you're working on small dramas like, do you all see the Walking Dead? Do you get the zombies? Shows like The Walking Dead, shows like Mad Men, shows like The Sopranos, shows like Game of Thrones, with all the terrible things going on. So that seems to be where the action is. Some things are actually being made in Texas. Some are being made up in Vancouver. A lot of it out in Los Angeles. Some of it in New York. So there are productions sort of all over the place. But one thing, a number of my students want to be screenwriters. We have a very good screenwriting staff, and one of the professors is writing for a television series right now. I think maybe Haven, one of the ones, it involves zombies and vampires, things like that. So like I said, it's interesting to me to see where are people getting jobs, you know, where are your career opportunities available. And in America right now, as I said, there's much more going on with television broadcasting and making things for cable channels. We're very interested in the States that, and I'll be curious if this is happening over here. We have television is changing a lot, and we have companies like Netflix is making their own shows, like Orange is the New Black, if you've seen that one about the women in prison. Amazon is making, you know, so we have people who are not traditional television producers, like our networks, and not even cable channels, or like HBO, or MTV, or things like that. We now have new players, such as I said, just the video providers, are becoming creators of content. So it's a very interesting time in America, especially for the combination of television, but also increasing more of it here through the internet and online is really changing what we think of as studying media. And it's throwing us faculty into all, you know, I mean, the simple story I took when I could tell all these stories from 1900 up here just about movies and movie theaters, with the coming of the internet and all the different kinds of entertainment you can get through your screen. Here, when you can get sports, here, when you can watch films mostly through the computer instead of going to a theater, all of my undergraduates no longer even have a television set. They watch all their television on their computers, on their laptops, and even on their little telephones. So the whole very idea of what these separate media are kind of converging in interesting ways that we're trying to understand. And I'll be very curious to learn what situations are going on here in Europe and in your country about what's similar and what's different, because I think we need to learn about those similarities and differences. So, how am I doing on time? Is it time for a break?
Yeah, 5 minutes.
Oh, hallelujah. So, how about we... Yes. I think we need a break now because it's very warm in here. And when we come back, I have some fun stories to tell. My next piece is going back to my map and actually talking about, so as I said, I have some fun stories to tell about individual exhibitors in the hard times of the Great Depression. But go, have a break. Have a break. It's very hot in here.